evening. So I thought, I always like to have names for talks. I thought this would be good to call Falling Apart and Being Okay. Or to sort of put it in a contemplative kind of way. You know, who is it that falls apart? And I thought this might be helpful because I've been falling apart in recent times, and it feels like a lot of people at some point in their life do fall apart, you know, do have really serious things happen. And so it's, you know, it's an opportunity to see how, does practice and when things in our daily life go wrong, how does the practice support us during those times? So I've had a cascade of experiences in the last 18 months that have really disrupted my identity, you know, really disrupted my sense of who I am. In the lay Western world, we have a sort of series of things that usually define us, you know, work, home, partners, children, country of origin. And when those things get pulled out, you know, we've got an opportunity to work out who we are. And what I noticed was that it's like there's two parts to the, well, the falling apart happened reasonably quickly, but the recovery process, I noticed there was two kind of parts. There was an internal part, which is very much to do with the Dharma, and there was a more external part, which is like to do with the Sangha and to do with the community. And I noticed all the way through that there were, I would reach out for help and I would receive it, you know, in so many different ways. Immense generosity of people who, when I was like absolutely desperate, like I didn't know if I could breathe for another few minutes unless somebody could, you know, validate my existence. You know, it was that kind of tenuous. And people kept on doing that, you know, and I saw how vulnerable I was and how much the whole teaching of interpenetration and interconnection, how extraordinarily true that is. Because I just couldn't be without other people at moments in time, you know, I just needed them. It was just such a profound example of the teachings. But at the same time, there was this internal place that I needed to inhabit of really trusting the Dharma, trusting the basic teachings that I am a Buddha, no matter what, you know, no matter what. And a particular teaching that was very helpful for me was just remembering that every moment, no matter what it is the only moment that I have to awaken to. It just isn't any other one than the one that I'm in, no matter how painful it is. It's just, the next moment hasn't come yet. It's that one that I'm in that has the potential to awaken me to who I am. I kept trusting that because I didn't feel that way. You know, I really didn't feel that way. So as Patrick mentioned, my original training is in the Diamond Sangha, which is a sort of a koan training tradition, and it's one of the ways that I find easiest to think about and express the Dharma to myself and to others. It's just a quality to it that works for me. I think it's partly because I'm not so good at a lot of the other ways. So the poetic leaps I can do. So I'd like to read one koan out of the Mamongkhan. I'd like to speak a little bit about Catherine and how she supported me last year and how that was an extraordinary expression of the embodiment of the Dharma, the way she supported me. So I'd like to describe that a little. And read a little bit from Pema Chodron because she is just such a wonderful teacher around the process of sort of disintegration and what do we do. So it sort of felt like the scaffolding had just dropped away, or like the rug had been pulled out. You know, there's lots of those sorts of sayings. And I kept on, you know, like I could be in the drama and I could also be saying, who is it that the scaffolding was holding up? You know, who had the rug pulled out? Who really was that, or who is that? And I knew it had to be something more than the pieces. You know, it had to be something more than the pieces. So there's a lovely case that kind of uses some of the similar images around falling apart. It's case 8 from the Mamongkhon, and this is Robert Aitken's translation and commentary. And the case is Si Chung builds carts. But sometimes my accent, carts, is like wagons, carts. Sometimes people say, what was that thing you were talking about? I didn't get what it was.
Cats.
Yeah, like cats, no. Carts.
It's good.
Yeah, carts. Okay. So the priest Yuan said to a monk, Si Chung made 100 carts. If you take off both wheels and the axle, what would be vividly apparent? So the priest Yuan said to a monk, Si Chung made 100 carts. If you take off both wheels and the axle, what would be vividly apparent? So Si Chung in Chinese mythology is sort of the inventor of the wheel, the inventor of carts. So the priest is, you know, inviting us to say, who is the original person? What happens when that original person loses both wheels and their axle? And there's a comment by Wu Men that says, if you realize this directly, your eye is like a shooting star and your act is like snatching a bolt of lightning. And there's a verse also, where the wheel revolves, even a master cannot follow it. The four cardinal half points, above, below, north, south, east, and west. So I'm going to read a little bit of what Aiken Roshi said here. So he makes the point about Si Chung being the mythical inventor of carts, and says, so Yuan is inviting us, he's asking a question. In effect, he is saying, I'm going to ask you a question about the original person and the original cart. Are you ready? Okay. Suppose you take that cart and remove the wheels and axle. What would be perfectly clear? Some people might answer, like a box or like a broken cart or something like that, or like the chassis, which is a fairly kind of innocent sort of response. But Yuan really means, what if we took all the pieces away? The front part, the back part, the cargo box, the seat, the wheels, the axle, everything. Then what would be vividly clear? If you say nothing, that won't do either. Yuan is not being one-sided. Roshi goes on to kind of contemporize it. So we don't see carts in Western society these days, but we do have pickups and cars. So suppose you take a pickup. You remove the body, the wheels, the axle, the headlights, the seats, the dashboard, the floorboards, the chassis, the cargo box, the steering mechanism, the suspension system, the engine, the transmission, and the gas tank. Then what will be crystal clear? Don't say a pile of parts. That isn't Yuan's point either. He is not giving lessons in mechanics. So I noticed that during this process, there was a great deal of fear, and fear really concretized things. I became very solid. other people became solid, like as if the cart had been welded into this like heavy, rigid, the wheels weren't even moved, just really heavy object. And I noticed how easy it is when there's a lot of fear to feel victim and assailant, you know, various different combinations of victim and assailant. So during this time, I lived very close to Catherine, only a few streets away, and I would go there uninvited. I'd just turn up like desperate. And luckily she seemed to always be there when I would go, which was just amazing. I'd knock on the door, please be there, please be there. She'd say, oh, Nettie, come in. And what's so interesting is sometimes she would just want all the details. So, what did you do then? And what did he say then? And what was the email? And you know, just every detail. Like, and she was so interested in every detail. And I'd be kind of telling her the details, thinking at the same time, like, this isn't really it. But I'm really glad that I'm telling her all the details. And it did validate them, you know. It was a wonderful expression of how all the everyday bits and pieces are really important, and they are sort of it, you know. They're it too. So she would just, and then other times I would go there ready with the latest piece to tell her, you know, the latest, what do you call soap operas, each
installment,
yeah, episode. I would be ready to give her the next episode, and instead she would just say, oh, let's go sit in the sun, and take two chairs out, and we'd sit there, and I would put my head on her shoulder, and she'd put her arm around me. I wouldn't say a single word. We'd just sit there, and then at some point she might go, oh, look, a hummingbird, something like that. And I'd be kind of like, mmm. I'd want to sort of start telling her stuff, but I would, you know, I listened to her teaching, you know, and just would rest, and just would rest, and let it all settle out, just let it all settle out. And that kind of settling out was like this part about the cart, you know. What is it when you take off the two wheels and the axle? What becomes vividly apparent? And there we would be. So I thought about that a little, that no matter how hypnotic the details were, when I would see Catherine, she would be able to, like, just let that all go. And at other times, when I was trying to be detached and trying to say, oh, well, look, it all kind of doesn't matter, she would be, oh, yes, it does. It really matters. Tell me what happened next, and I'll give you advice on what I think you should do. She wouldn't say it that way, but she would, you know, make suggestions of what I could do next. So I'm very, very grateful to her. And I know a lot of people have already spoken about the great privilege of being with her in her last days, and if there's time, there's another case I'd like to read in relation to that, but I want to make sure there's time for discussion, because I think falling apart is something that people resonate with, and I want to make sure that there can be some dialogue about that. So I'm going to read a little bit from Pema. And this book is called When Things Fall Apart. So one of her many wonderful books. When things fall apart, we're on the verge of we know not what. The test of each of us is to stay on that brink and not concretize. And she talks a little bit about her experience of first becoming abbot at Genpo Abbey, and how difficult that was for her when she thought she was, you know, wonderful and great and good, and it kind of crumbled for a while, and how she allowed that to expand her sense of who she was. And actually that was a big part of it for me, was I was pretty sure I was a pretty good person before all this happened to me. And I was pretty sure that I had no enemies, I was a solid practitioner, I was a very good person in the world, generating good karma, doing good deeds, very genuinely. I could really have this sense of myself as a good person. I still think I am, but in that process of falling apart, I got to see the places I hadn't looked at, you know. And I think all of us have some blind spots, and maybe some of us don't ever get to look at them. You know, life doesn't throw us such a hard kind of curveball, and we don't. And that's, you know, maybe a shame. Although I wouldn't want to wish bad things on anyone, but we have blind spots, just places that we don't want to go. And I just got, as if you couldn't have a more perfect storm for me to face all my deepest fears. And I'm incredibly grateful to Kokyo and the Sangha here for being so welcoming. It's been a huge part of my recovery. I really, really appreciate it. Oh, and I'll just say something about my teacher in Sebastopol, Daniel Tiranyo. He did something similar to Catherine. It was really kind of amazing. There was a period of time when I was really fairly fragmented, and so he said, okay, this is going to be our practice. In the morning, I will call you, and the evening, you call me. And we'll just do that as practice. And we did that for a number of months. And it was kind of similar. Sometimes he would, like, all the details, and then other times, like, Nettie, you don't really have a problem, you know. I remember when he said that, I was just ready to hear it. Had he said it a few weeks earlier, I would have not been able to hear that. I would have been, no, I have a huge problem. He had a similar quality to Catherine that way. It was very, very instructive. So this wonderful quote that Hema says, it was a sign she had pinned up on her wall. She doesn't say where it came from. Only to the extent that we expose ourselves over and over to annihilation can that which is indestructible be found in us. Ah, well, that would make sense. Oh, that's great, yeah. So only to the extent that we expose ourselves over and over to annihilation can that which is indestructible be found in us. Actually, that is so interesting, because one of the turning points for me was, you know, that film, Crazy Monk? Crazy Wisdom. I went to see that film thinking, I was feeling terrible and thinking, this will lift my spirits. This film will. I mean, if there's anything that can lift my spirits, a film about a great Buddhist master who's very innovative and creative, and I haven't seen it before, this is bound to do something. And I sat there through the film completely, like, anhedonic. Just didn't do anything. The film didn't do anything. And it was such an alert to me. Oh my gosh, if even something like this, the thing that's closest to my heart, isn't penetrating right now, there's really a problem. What am I going to do? You know? And it was a real alarm. It was a real alarm that I had to reach out even further for more resources, reach out to more people. And so I did. I just did. Just called more people, visited more people. People I didn't know very well. Just called them anyway. Hello. I was wondering if you wanted to go for a walk on Westcliff. So that's wonderful that that's from him, because he jolted me. Only to the extent that we expose ourselves over and over to annihilation can that which is indestructible be found in us. So with the case I mentioned, with case 8, I mentioned woman's comment and woman's verse. So the comment is, if you realize this directly, your eye is like a shooting star and your act is like snatching a bolt of lightning. And I think when we are in a desperate place, each moment that we're in that desperate place is this opportunity. And do we take it? Do we take that opportunity? Whatever it is, sometimes I would have a new thought and I wouldn't want to have that new thought because it meant I'd have to do something different and I didn't want to have to do something different. I kind of wanted to stay in some kind of blaming place or some kind of victim place, and then this new thought was saying, no, maybe you need to do this thing. And so I, kept on trusting that these moments are vital moments. This is our life. I think Kathy Toldy and I were talking the other day, and she said practice like you have your head on fire. And that's really what it's like. Actually, there's another line that I like that Aitken Roshi quite often mentions. I won't go from where it all comes from, just to this line here. The Buddha replied, "He is like the fine horse who runs even at the shadow of a whip." I've kept that line in my mind a lot. Can I be like the horse that runs just at the shadow of the whip? I don't want to have to be touched by the whip. I don't want to have to be struck by the whip. Certainly don't want to have to be beaten till I'm bleeding by the whip before I, do a little bit of waking up, before I do a little bit of waking up. So, can you be like the horse that moves just to the shadow of the whip? And I think it's very protective if we strengthen our practice while we're not in a state of crisis, if we just practice, like imagining there's going to be one. I mean, we're obviously all going to die. So if nothing else, that crisis is going to arise, or that experience. And can we practice now with that sort of strength, with that determination? Not have to go ch-ch, not have to wait for that to happen. We have to wait for the whip to crack before we do. So, the comment, if you realize this directly, your eye is like a shooting star and your act is like snatching a bolt of lightning. And then the verse, where the wheel revolves, even a master cannot follow it. The four cardinal half points, above, below, north, south, east and west. So I just want to read what Aitken Roshi said about the verse. Where the wheel revolves, even a master cannot follow it. Wu Man calls his book the Gateless Barrier, and he is erecting solid barriers everywhere. Here is another one. How is it that even a true maestro cannot follow the music, and an expert wheelwright cannot follow a wheel's course? When the wheel turns, nobody can follow it. That's the truth of it, expert or no expert. The four cardinal half points, above, below, north, south, east and west. This refers to the four half points of the compass, north, east, northwest, southeast, southwest, together with above and below, and north, south, east and west. The half points form the 10 directions, which we chant in our sutra. 10 directions. The four cardinal half points also are the four cardinal virtues: propriety, righteousness, integrity, and modesty. I just this afternoon reading a book about the Dalai Lama. I nearly always weep when I read about the Dalai Lama, because he is so unbelievably modest. I'm going to cry right now. Just, I think we are so lucky to be alive at the same time as him. You know, that occurred to me recently. I kind of took it for granted, you know, I'm here, the Dalai Lama's here. And then I thought, oh my gosh, I could have been born when he wasn't here. And if he's going to pass away, maybe before me. And I'm here on the planet at the same time as this extraordinary man. And his modesty just makes me weep. Such a wonderful person. So this meaning is an overtone in Wumen's verse, suggesting the nobility of the master. Thus, in those final two lines of his verse, Wumen is really pointing to you as the noble master. In effect, he is asking you, where does the wheel turn? Where does the cart go? Don't say nowhere. Even a stone goes somewhere. Don't say everywhere. Even the air is still. Where does the cart go? Samantabhadra knows. Roshi often writes like that. Little, sharp, beautiful things. So I kind of would like to open for discussion, and if that peters out or something, then I'll read case 6. But let's see if I open it up for conversation. Jean.
I think it's fair to say that a horse might run from the shadow of a whip because the horse has tasted the whip at some point.
Yeah.
So partly what the horse is doing is remembering lesson learned.
Yes.
So I wonder, for you, when things fall apart, what practice do you have to remember a lesson learned? And maybe you only have to experience that once.
Yeah, it would be good to only have to experience it once. What I've noticed is the process of deepening of practice. So like a simple thing like the middle way, I'll sometimes hear that again, go, oh, the middle way. Oh my God. And it will just drop to another level, you know, of understanding. So the very simple verses and phrases that we know through sort of coming from Christian backgrounds, I found that those things started to come to me, really surprisingly how often they did. I don't know if I can think of any right now. But just those sort of love thy neighbour as thyself, and they would just sort of come into my head, oh. Father, forgive them, they know not what they do. You know, they just arrive from my early childhood and resonate in a new way. Yeah, I'm not sure I know what. Can you say more about the remembering piece?
Well, for example, you're remembering lines from scripture of other faith tradition,
mm-hmm.
or remembering the phrase the middle way, as you just described it, and then, oh, the middle way, and then meeting what's in front of you with that.
Yes.
Present.
Yes.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I found was I would make the same mistakes over and over and have to be humbled every time. Like, damn it! I wasn't going to do that. You know. And then you just you just move on at that moment. You just let that go at that moment. You don't waste time there. You just don't waste time there. You go, oh, right, fresh moment, you know. There's a wonderful case two, Pai Chang's fox, that begins with a priest going into the Dharma hall, and at the end of each talk he would leave and then come to the next talk, and then he would leave. And one time he stayed behind and he stayed, he didn't leave. And for me, I thought of that image about just staying steady in that moment when I've made a mistake, just stay there and be aware of what just happened and then let it pass. You know, let it pass. Because we're tied by our past, by cause and effect and karma, and we're free at every moment at the same time. Always we've got this legacy, so we have to be, that fits with about remembering, we have this legacy, that these habits of mind and these, whichever way you want to put it, karmic history, that means we act in certain ways, but we're still fresh and free to do something different. It just might take an awful lot of times.
Struck, no pun intended, by your comment that when you notice that you just have a lack of engagement, even with the film about Trungpa, that to you that was a sign of how far gone you were, and that your response was, oh, I need to reach out more.
Yes.
I think that's very powerful to reflect on, because I know when I feel like I'm falling apart, my tendency is to want to retreat and not to reach out. Like, uh-oh, I'm really in a bad place. I better go further in.
Yeah.
You know? And so the thought of, oh, actually, I need to reach out, and that you continued to do that, and just to continue to open yourself to, in a way, it's like to that which you don't know. Because when we retreat, we're basically hanging out with what we do know, our story, our pitiful, poor pitiful me story.
Right.
When you reach out, you're exposing yourself to something else.
Yes.
You know?
And to potential rejection.
Yeah. Or, well, not really, because we went from the wrong, and I still feel crummy.
Yeah.
But that just really strikes me. Mm-hmm. And it makes me think of something that I read that I just wanted to share.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a book called How We Pray, and it's a man who's not really religious. He doesn't identify as religious, but he was talking about how he got healed himself from a meth addiction, and he was really, really far gone in his addiction. And when he was just starting to have the wish to recover, he had a dream where he was on one side of the river, and he was on the other side of the river. And the he that was on the other side of the river reached out his hand for the he that was on that side of the river. And he said that experience of being reached out to and grasping the supportive hand of his own, you know, self was the what gave him the strength to, you know, move into recovery. And as a quote-unquote non-spiritual person, he said, perhaps that was my prayer. And as you were talking, I was just really thinking about that essay and that act.
Yeah. That feels like a beautiful visual example of that inner knowing that we are all Buddha. You know, he reached out to himself. You know, he reached out to himself. There was that part of him that knew he's essentially good, knew that he's essentially got nothing to do with meth. I mean, it's just got nothing to do with him in many ways. He's something so much more. That's wonderful, yeah. And that, I think that's a good point too, about when I came out from the film and did something, that ability to do something came from practice partly, you know, that I have to be more than this terrible state that I'm in. I am a Buddha. I can, you know, I am. I've been studying this for years. I believe it. I believe it. So if I believe it, I must act on it. I just have to act on it, even if I don't quite know what will happen. And you know, reaching out, and you know, you send text messages and you leave voice messages and you don't get replies, but at some point you do. It's like, yes, yes, someone replied. And then there's that other part of the teaching about interconnection, how much we need each other. Chris?
You spoke about concretizing around your fear. And I find that sometimes I tell myself stories, or I believe a story, and just by having the story, I give it more weight, I make it more solid, I find more supporting evidence.
Yes.
Can you tell me how you were working with that?
I did keep telling myself that this is not right. This is not true. It feels true. It feels really true that I'm a victim here. It really does. But I, you know, a voice would say that, but this is a mundane way to look at it. You know, this is a mundane way to look at it. There must be. Somewhere I remember hearing that when we have a thought that disturbs our mind, then it's an inaccurate thought. And when we have a thought that settles our mind, then it's probably a fairly accurate one. So whenever I'd have those concretizing thoughts, it was extremely distressing. So I would kind of, that part of me that could watch would say, you are thinking about this wrongly. You don't know how to think about it differently yet, but at some point you might, at some point you will. Well, I just would say at some point I will. And it would be, sometimes be the middle of the night. Like I was giving this talk, it was kind of like, get your act together as best as you can before the talk on Wednesday, because I want to give a genuine talk. And at 3 o'clock this morning, I woke up and had an incredibly useful thought, you know, just a bam, and I didn't really want to have it, because it meant I had to let go of a bunch of stuff and soften in a particular way. But I felt myself saying, no, I don't want to have to think that, don't want to have to, and I just did, and it just, you know. So I'm really grateful to Kokyo that he asked me to do this talk, because I didn't feel at all equipped. But this is again about going with what's arising. He asked, I didn't feel equipped, but I thought I will just do it, and it will, the process will equip me. It will do it for me. I just have to pay attention. It'll do it for me.
I found a lot of the words that we use are no longer useful to me. And a couple of them are death and rebirth. I think they're stupid. What I like better is transformation and emergence. Because it addresses what you're talking about. And I'm really with you on this, because I've experienced this sort of thing. I don't know what it is, but I've experienced this sort of thing.
It kind of doesn't matter what it is, really, does it?
Apart.
Yeah.
And I won't repeat the whole story here, but I had the privilege and honor of watching a chicken hatch when I was 9 years old. And it was very frustrating watching this poor chicken. And the docent who was watching me watch him, I didn't know the docent was there, when I screamed, won't somebody help this chicken get out of his shell? He said, we can't do that. Because if we did that, the blood would never get to his wingtips and he would die and he would never know what it was like to be a chicken. And so I'm thinking, you know, I get complacent with my cocoons, and I forget that it's a cocoon. I forget that I'm actually transforming into something, and I won't know what it is until it breaks when I get out of it. And I find it aggravating and very inconvenient most times. My cocoon usually breaks just when I finish furnishing it again. I just remodeled my cocoon. It's very annoying. But I can really get this idea of realizing that when I feel my world is falling apart, it is both my cocoon and my complacence are falling apart. And it's when I suffer great loss from several deaths that came about, I realized that 98% of my grief was grievance. And 2% of it was wonder. This little chicken, by the way, I was told to go away and come back in an hour. And I was told to go feed the llama that's ripe for Christmas. So I came back in an hour. And this little chicken, which had been so hopeless, it seemed, ugly, wet, you know, just ugly, big eyes, skinny neck, you know, very shaking. When I came back after an hour, it was all yellow and fuzzy, and it was the boss of the world, and it was eating its shell. So I like to settle in that 2% wonder sometimes when I have big grievances and say, I wonder what I am. And I realize that the cocoon is actually only the size of a moment. If I can be aware of that 1,000 times a day, then when the really big deals seem to show up, it's just another moment.
Yeah.
And I'm well rehearsed. So thank you very much for bringing this up, because I get to say a little bit in celebration of how I heal from this sort of place. It was horrible. But I appreciate your bringing your transformation and your emergence to us. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
You don't have to be patient.
There's a case about the monk says to the teacher, "I'm pecking from the inside. Please, Master, help me. Can you peck from the outside?" I can't remember the rest of it right now, but it's a very tender image of the monk asking, "Please, teacher, help me. I'm pecking from the inside. It's difficult. Please help me peck from the outside." But, just like you said, sometimes it's best not to do that, and because we have to walk our own path, and nobody can really show us that path. So the master doesn't peck from the outside. They can help us, they can watch us, but we have to walk our own path with our friends. Patrick.
I like what you said about this falling apart pointed you towards things you have not looked at about yourself, covered other territory. And I would hope that in my life that this practice lets me sit a little longer in that kind of vulnerable place with things that I don't want to look at very much, but maybe I can, you know, sit with a little longer. I can't say that that always happens, to be honest. It's such a tendency to want to gloss over things that, like Kathy says, maybe pull back and cover up even more. I'd like to think that this practice, with its, I can sit here one more breath, or I can sit here one more day, allows us to be a little more vulnerable and sit with difficult things.
Yeah, so we don't have to go searching. just pay attention to whatever is happening, and it doesn't have to be a drama. It's better if it's not. I think we need to finish. Thank you, everyone. Beings are